Today I want to talk to you about some, I would say, core aspects of Werner Herzog's filmmaking, some recurring motifs in his films, and some keywords which seem to me relevant to define his way of filmmaking and his way of seeing the importance in filmmaking. And one of these keywords is certainly the word authenticity, which today is used in many, many contexts, but of course originally it was used for documents. A document could be authentic or not. And I think that it is important when you have the word authenticity to know that it's always an impression. So authenticity is refers to the impression of something. Because you only, you know, it's only an impression if something is real or true or not. It's referring to your idea of the object you are referring to. Is this object authentic or not? This is your idea of the object. It's an impression. That's what authenticity is referring to. And I think it's referring to two interrelated but slightly different impressions. One is the impression of being real as a contrast or an opposite to being faked. And one could say that this relates to materiality, of the materiality of the object, or here I have written the body. And the other impression is the impression of being true as an opposite, of course, to being false, and that, of course, refers more to the content than to the materiality. I think these are the two meanings in the word authenticity. And if one looks at Werner Herzog's way of filmmaking, I think one can find exactly those two meanings of authenticity, and I want to start with the impression of being real and not fake, the reference to the body and to the materiality. And the first keyword here is space. So the unity of space, for example, is, and the homogeneity of space is very important to Herzog in different kind of senses. One is that he usually in his fiction films of the 70s, for example, he loved to work with sequence shots, so to cut with very few cuts. And so to hold the camera in order to give an impression of the space to the spectator. If you cut all the time, the spectator doesn't know anymore how the space is organized. And for him, it was very important that the spectator understood the space where the story was evolving. And not only the spectator, but also his actors, one could say, and also himself, because this is one of the, I've told you that he loves to tell myths all the time and to tell anecdotes and legends about his life. And one of those myths is, for example, that he was a football amateur football player in a soccer team in Bavaria, and when he was younger, and he was a forward, and he's said to have marked many, many, many goals, although he was a very bad player technically. And he explains that by saying, yeah, it's my sense of the space. I always knew where the goal was, and I could kick the ball, and because I have such a good organization of the space and so on, I have a feeling for the space. This is very important for me. And for the filmmaking, it's the same. He says that when he goes to the set, he always wants to be there first, and he wants to help organizing the set himself. He wants to put the table there and then to try to put the table on the other side of the set and so on. He wants to get the feeling of the space. And he wants his actors, of course, to get the same feelings, and then the spectators to get also the same feeling. And this was achieved in many of his films by, as I've said, by working with sequence shots. So, and this is, I think, one item of authenticity of space. And a second point would be characters. I mean, he's famous for working with amateurs, with laymen. I have already given you some examples. One was Bruno S., the guy who played then Kaspar Hauser, for example. Then the dwarfs, for example, that were cast for this dwarf film, they were, of course, amateurs and not actors. Or all those indigenous people in his films. Or I have mentioned this strong man for Invincible, who was a real world champion strongman at the time, and of course not an actor at all, so no professional actors. That is another item of authenticity, and directly connected to this is, I would say, an authenticity of actions. That means that when he casts amateurs, it's not so much that the acting is authentic, in the sense that you have the impression that the dialogues, what this person says on the screen, is really authentical or so, because often I would say it's better to cast a professional actor if you want to achieve this kind of authenticity, because he can be trained to act and say things as if he was someone else, but for amateurs on the camera, it's often not so easy. But what is authentic, and this is why he casts those people, are their actions. So if he casts the strong man, and I will later show you a clip, as a person, he's not very authentic when he speaks and so on. It's really, it's bad. It seems fake. So you don't believe that he's this Jewish strongman he's supposed to be. You believe that he is a strongman because he really can lift weight. This is the action. This is what Herzog wants. But you don't believe that he's the particular strongman, this Jewish strongman of the 1930s, that he is in the film. You don't believe that because he's a bad actor, or he's not an actor at all. So the action is important. And I give you one very, it's not that famous, but for me it's one of the most exciting, maybe, examples of the authenticity of action in his films. And for me it's also one of the most exciting sequences of a climbing scene of a mountain film sequence in film history, and you will soon know why I say that. There it is. So this is a film about a climbing competition on a real mountain, the Cerro Torre in South America, and we see. And for the film, one of the protagonists that was cast was a real free climber, world champion of free climbing at the time, a German guy named Stefan Glowacz. And what he does in this sequence, this is real. He really did it. And it's absolutely amazing, I think. On the other part, On the other hand, the reviews for this film said that as an actor, it's absolutely impossible. So, and the film in total, I think it's one of the worst Herzog films. I've told you, this is the first film he didn't write the script for, and the narration, it's really a bit strange and so on. But this sequence, I think, is absolutely great. So she says, oh, he's climbing without safety. And then the other says, yeah, yeah, that, but he wants to. That's what he wants. And also here you see it's not cutting, it's a sequence shot. So you get an impression of the whole space. So I'll leave the following seconds for a particular reason. I'm going to talk about it soon. What do I think about? Nothing.
Yes.
So, I find this climbing scene absolutely amazing. But and I think, I don't know if it was Mission Impossible 1 or 2, with Tom Cruise, it's in the beginning, I think, it seems to me a copy of this scene somehow, only that, of course, for the Tom Cruise film, there are a lot of shots, and it's, of course, fake. He didn't climb it. but this is, I think you could see it in this, I mean, there was one cut, I think, in the middle, but he started with this pan of the camera that you could get a real impression of how high he's climbing and so on, and how the landscape is organized. And I've read that this guy had to repeat this sequence 5 or 6 times. So, okay. And then I've left the following seconds because there were already some of the motifs that I'm going to talk about today. The first one was this kind of dream or vision of the guy, and the girl was asking, what are you thinking about? He said nothing, and it was clearly by this distortion effect, it was clearly visible. And first you had this close shot of his head, he was thinking, and then you saw these distorted pictures. It was clearly a dream or a vision, and dreams and visions are recurring, very, very important motifs in Herzog's filmmaking. And then that was followed by this circle effect, and circles are another very important motif that we are going to talk about today. And then I've also left this last shot where both of them lie nude on the bed, because only to tell you that Herzog has repeatedly claimed that in his films you will never see nude people and sex scenes, you will never see people making telephone calls, and you will never see people driving a car, because he finds it absolutely horrible. And it's not, and I've left that because it's not entirely true. So this is one of the very, very, very few nude scenes in Herzog cinema. And what is true is you will never see somebody make love to another or to have sex or something. This doesn't exist in his cinema. And I think it's only now in his latest American films, like Bad Lieutenant, for example, there's a lot of car driving and maybe also telephoning. But it's true that in his earlier films, this also didn't exist. By the way, this is a contrast to Rainer Werner Fassbinder, who is also from Bavaria and from the same generation. In his films, there is a lot of telephone calls and lovemaking and maybe also car driving. It's also because Fassbinder has other interests, and Fassbinder also is a guy who came from the theater. And for example, Werner Herzog hates the theater, and he hates particularly the way people talk in this theater, and he doesn't like this. Is also maybe one of the reasons why he casts loves to cast amateurs and so on, because he doesn't like the way theater actors, this rhetorical way of, you know, speaking very consciously and so on. He doesn't like that. And I mean, commenting his in the off commentary, commenting his own documentaries and so on, you can clearly hear that he, for example, has not a trained voice, and this is something that he loves. He loves people who have not a trained voice, but maybe authentic voice. So let's go for a second back to this. Yeah, sound, and that was the keyword for sound, because as I've said, the actions have to be authentic. That's very important to him. But of course, the you can't, not everything can be authentical. You have to make compromises. And one of the compromises that he makes is in terms of sound or language. And one good example is to show that, now I go back to the clips again, is the film Invincible, with this strong man. Because the strong man is supposed, I've told you that, supposed to be a Jewish blacksmith from Poland who in the early 1930s goes to Berlin, to Germany. And so Jewish, Polish, and then Germany. But the actor, of course, is Finnish. And in the film, he speaks English. And he speaks English with an horrible accent and also with a very annoying speech disorder that he has. And so that's not very authentical if you take that seriously. If you hear him speak, I mean, you wouldn't think this is a Jewish blacksmith from Poland in the 1930s in Germany. And in this sequence that I'm going to show, but of course, what was more important to Herzog was that he could lift the weights, you know, and he wouldn't have to apply any tricks or so. And the same goes for the female character that you're going to see, because in the film she's a piano player, and of course he cast a real professional, very good piano player, a Russian piano player. Her name is Anna Gurari, or Gurari also. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. And I mean, for her, it's not... I think in the film she says that she is a stateless person, and then she was at the conservatory in Prague, I think, and so on. And so in reality, she's Russian, so that's quite okay. But still, I mean, they talk English with each other in Germany in the 1930s. This is not authentic. So, but I show you the sequence. And by the way, I also show it to you because you can clearly see that these two guys are not professional actors. And I think in this film, that's a bit of a problem because they fall in love with each other and so on. And it's not very, very intense. It's not very real because I think for such kind of scenes, maybe professional actors would have been better.
I didn't want to disturb you. I'm sorry.
You're not disturbing me at all. Please stay.
That was really wonderful.
Why don't you sit down next to me?
Conservatory
in Prague. You see, I had high hopes then, and I've never really given them up.
And why are you here?
The reason is that I'm a stateless person. Do you know what that means? No. As a child, they kept pushing me around between three countries. I never knew my parents. And when Hanusen was in Prague, he took me away with him.
He was in Prague?
Yes, in Prague. And he gave me work with his palace orchestra. I'm sure you have noticed that he doesn't treat me well.
Yes, I noticed that.
But I stay with him all the same. What is? Why am I still with him?
Miss Martha, I wanted to... I am...
Zisha, I know what you mean.
Your music, it's so beautiful when you play.
See, I have a dream.
Can you tell me what it is?
Someday, I'd like to play Beethoven's third piano concerto with a full orchestra to accompany me. I would give anything for that. I have a vision deep inside. Come with me. I'll show you. These beings. For me, they have the purest of souls. I have never seen anything more beautiful, more delicate. I want to play music to match this vision. It's deep inside me.
See your soul.
Stop here. So maybe you don't find this scene as bad as I find it, but it's maybe also a matter of taste, but I mean also the music is quite atypical for a Herzog film. It's quite kitschy, I think, this music, this love music in this scene. And normally he is a, I would say, a bit better taste for music. And I've left this sequence until the end because I don't know how these animals are. She said it, but I don't understand it, how they are called in English. But keep them in your mind because we will see them again. So this is seems to be a very an image, these animals for what did she say, for soul or something that Herzog likes a lot because it shows up in other films of his. And of course, as I've said, we are going to talk about dreams and visions as a motive, and here again it was she was talking about her vision and her dream and so on. This is really recurring in all of his films, that people have dreams and visions. And I go back to this chart, and the next point is traveling on foot. And I mean, we have seen this clip from his portrait of himself that he has made there in Bavaria, and we see him going on foot, and he talks a lot about traveling on foot, how important it is to him and so on. And indeed, I would say this, I mean, this, traveling on foot, he has talked so much about it throughout his career. And as he explained in this portrait, most of his films and his scripts were made while he was traveling on foot and walking around. So it's a kind of authentical imprint that he then leaves on his products, one could say, because they are made up in the moment when he is traveling on foot. And also, I mean, he always says that all his films, he not only says that all his films are Bavarian films, but he also says that all his films are made on foot or something like that. This is an image that he uses. And so athletic filmmaking is something that he is always talking about. And or he has, for example, said things like, okay, you could, if I would go blind, I would still continue filmmaking, but if I lose my legs, I will stop immediately because my legs are the most important thing for my filmmaking. Yeah. And it's the kind of, one could also say, maybe this is the kind of street credibility as authenticity that he adds to his film. Is his all, it's at least he claims that, yeah. One does never know. I mean, for example, I don't think that he still talks a lot about traveling on foot, but I don't think that in the last 20 years he has traveled a lot on foot. Not only because, I mean, he lives in California now. I've tried to walk in Los Angeles, but it's really not a good idea. And so I don't think that he is going on foot very much nowadays. But still, and I mean, for example, I don't know if you know the writer Bruce Chatwin, who has written these, what is that, Dream Paths or so of the Aborigines is one of his topics and so on. This was a guy who traveled a lot on foot, and Herzog was a friend. They became friends. They were really friends. And when Chatwin died, he gave his backpack to Herzog, and Herzog then used it and so on. And Herzog also made his last film with Klaus Kinski, Cobra Verde. This is based on a book by Bruce Chatwin, for example. So he's really serious about this traveling on foot, and I give you more examples. For example, he has always, and this is also in the interview, in the part of the interview that I've copied for you, I think so. He has always said, for example, that all the important things in your life you have to do on foot. Yeah, and then he gives examples like, if you live in England and your fiancée, the girl you want to marry, lives in Sicily, if you want to propose to her, you have to go there on foot. It's absolutely necessary. These are the kind of examples that he gives. And of course, we have already learned, I've told you that I think in the first lecture, this, or it, yeah, and it's one of the myths, and it's also in this interview, that he, when he was 14, traveled on foot to Albania, and then he couldn't go in, but then he went on foot along the border and so on. And so this is one of his famous travels on foot. Of course, in this case, nobody knows if it's true or not. There is no proof. And then the other one is, and he has talked about it in this portrait of himself. He has tried, because in the 1980s, of course, Germany was still divided into West and East, and he, in the mid-1980s, he tried to walk around both parts of Germany symbolically in order to hold them and bring them together. And he didn't achieve it in the end. I mean, he fell ill or something and had to stop this travel. But this is quite well known, because later on an official occasion he was asked to give a speech about something in Germany, and then in the speech he was talking about his experiences during this voyage, this travel on foot. So, and the most important and best known traveling on foot story is, and he has also talked about this in the clip, is his march from Munich to Paris in the winter, November, I think, of 1974 or so. And he also gave the reason. This old woman, Lotte Eisner, who lived in Paris, was very, very ill, and he didn't want her to die. And so he said to himself, okay, if I go there on foot, she will not die. And then he went there on foot, and indeed, she lived for another 10 years. And then his joke is that he said after 10 years, then he told her, okay, now you are allowed to die. And then she died. And story is so well known because he made a book out of it, a kind of the diaries of this voyage. And of course, I mean, maybe he wrote some of that while walking, but still, I mean, he worked on that later on, I think. And but it's if you know a little bit of, I mean, there is a tradition, especially in the German language, there is a tradition since the early 19th century of such travel reports of people who traveled on foot. And nowadays, mostly journalists somehow, but of course there are different kind of people who did something like that and who reported later on that. That is what is important. But if you compare Herzog's approach in the book to all the other literature of that kind, it really sticks out as something special. And for one reason, because in this book he is not interested in the landscape or in the people he meets and in this kind of experiences during the walk and so on, but the only thing he is really interested in is the because I mean, it's winter, it's very cold, he walks kind of like 50 kilometers per day, he doesn't take really money, he doesn't stay in hotels or something like that, but he breaks into vacation houses or into things like that, and he steals food and so on. This is kind of his way of doing that. And of course, this is quite hard to do that in 700 kilometers in winter. And so of course this is exhaustive, and he starts, so what he describes in the book is the kind of hallucinations that he gets while walking. I mean, if you ever experience something like that, walking really long distances, you can really follow him, because really your mind gets somewhere else, it leaves the body and is somewhere else. And this is the topic, so to speak, of this book. And I think it's the only book of that kind that is concentrated on exactly this that I know of. So, and one could ask, but why was this woman so important for him, this Lotte Eisner? And he explained it a little bit. The film, you have to know that this Lotte Eisner was one of the first female film critics in Germany. And now we're talking about the 1920s. She worked at that time for the most important, and at that time there were a lot of film journals, magazines, newspapers, and so on. And she worked for the most important in Berlin, the Film Kurier. And because of that, she knew all these director heroes of that time personally, like Fritz Lang, Murnau, Pabst, and all these Weimar cinema, German silent film heroes of the time. She knew them personally. But she was Jewish, so she went to France then in the early 1930s, and she was arrested and put into a camp in France. And she was lucky. I think she had some friends outside, and right before she would have been deported, she could escape. And then immediately after the war, she became, because immediately after the war, or even this guy had already started before the war and throughout the war, but immediately after war, he went serious with the idea of creating the first film archive, Cinémathèque in France, Henri Langlois. And she was then immediately after war the most important collaborator of this Henri Langlois, and she stated that in Paris, Paris at the Cinémathèque for many years until her death. And people today say that she was maybe the only intellectual academic person in this Cinémathèque, because the other loved film or so, but they were not trained film historians or something like that. And she is important, especially for a German film history, for two things. One is that it's because of her book, The Haunted Screen, it is called, that it's about expressionist cinema. And it's because of this book and two studies on Murnau and Lang that these films, these German film classics of the 20s that were forgotten, almost forgotten in the 1940s and 50s, that they were rediscovered and re-evaluated. This is because of her. That's one thing. And the other thing is that and this is what Herzog mentions, for his generation, so the filmmakers who were young in the late 60s and the 70s, the new German film generation of the time, Volker Schlöndorff, Wim Wenders, and Werner Herzog, for example, or Rainer Werner Fassbinder, for them, she was the most important person at all, because they said, we are a fatherless generation, because our father generation, they were all involved in the Nazism, so we can't take them as models. So we have to go back to the grandfather generation of the silent film era. The problem is, we don't know them. They are dead, or if they still live like Fritz Lang, we are not in contact with them. We don't know them. And so Lotte Eisner became the bridge, because she knew the old guys personally, and she cared about the young guys. And that's what, so these young filmmakers said, okay, she gives us legitimation. And for example, in the second edition and a slightly revised edition of her book, The Haunted Screen, which originally was only about the silent film era, she has a chapter on Herzog's first feature film, Signs of Life, from 1968, saying, okay, this is really a very important film, and this is a film in the tradition of the German filmmaking of the silent era and so on. And she wrote a letter to Fritz Lang, there is real filmmaking again in Germany, because of course, in the 1950s and 60s, the German film industry was very much in decline. And so this is the reason. And for example, if you know the Wim Wenders film, it's his most best-known film, Paris, Texas, because this is the only German film that won the Golden Palm in Cannes. And this film is dedicated to Lotte Eisner, for example. Or Herzog's Kaspar Hauser film is also dedicated to Lotte Eisner. And so this is behind this walk. Another important story is coming back to the traveling experience is that he was asked also in this interview book, he was asked, so what, I mean, he was never, and he is very happy about it, I think, he never went to a film school, but he was asked, okay, if you had a film school, how would you run it? And then he said, okay, if somebody would apply for my film school, I would not be interested in if this guy had already made a film or something like that. Absolutely no interesting. This guy had to walk from Madrid to Kiev, like 5,000 kilometer on foot, and he had to write a diary and send me the diary. That would be the application. And I would read the diary, and I could, when I read it, I would find out if this is true or not, if this guy had really walked or not. And this is the application, for example. This is one of the stories. But what is behind that, and I think behind all this legendary stuff and so on, is something which is really important. And I think in this point, he's really right. And he says that explicitly in the interview. He said, filmmaking must have experience of life as its foundation. This is what it's then all about for him. It's like today you go to a film school and you know how to use you learn how to use a camera and this and that and this and that. And he, by the way, he's not the only filmmaker who says that. He says, yeah, okay, but no, you can learn that by doing. This is not the important thing about filmmaking. The important thing about filmmaking is that you have something to say. And if you don't have experience of life, you don't have anything to say that is important. So that is behind this idea of walking. And for example, one of the other legends that he always tells is that when he was still at school, I think he was during the day he was going to school, and at night he was working in a factory as a welder in a steel factory to earn money for his first film or something like that. But this is something that if it's true or not, but it's important for him, yeah, that somebody has done something in real life, worked, for example, like a worker and so on. Yeah. And then he says, for example, yeah, aspiring filmmakers have to be taught that sometimes the only way of overcoming problems involve real physicality. Yeah, that's really important for him. And then the contrast for him to filmmaking is academia, university. He hates that. Academia is the death of cinema, also film studies, he hates that, yeah? It is the very opposite of passion, yeah? Academic writing, for him, it's not physical because it lacks pain, or it lacks, one could say, authenticity, it lacks ecstasy or whatever. And I don't think he's right about it because he doesn't know anything about academia, maybe. But okay, for him, it's the image, yeah? Those are the guys who only talk, and on the other hand are the guys who have real experience because they do something in real life with physicality. And but okay, what he wants to stress that what for him it's more important is the physical, is the sensual, anything that involves the body. That's why I've talked about authenticity of the body. And the other things are only invented, and they lack a connection to the real truth. So that's the authenticity behind it. Yeah, but it's interesting with this film school then, because he says, okay, the basic skills, for example, for a filmmaker are learning languages is important for him, driving a car, typing, boxing, juggling, magic tricks. So this is something he said about 10 years ago. And interestingly enough, since 2 years, he really has a film school. and it's called the Rogue Film School, but it's not a film school like a film academy or something. It's like workshops, so for 2 or 3 days, so a long weekend, you can book this workshop, and you, I think nothing of that he has said 10 years ago had come true, because you don't have to apply by walking from Madrid to Kiev. You just apply with a DVD of something that you have done, quite ordinary. And the most important thing, you have to pay for 1 weekend $1,500 that include nothing, no hotel, no food, only the presence of Werner Herzog. And it's like 3 days, I think 65 people, each of them pay 1,500. And this guy comes and then tells them, I think what he does in the film school is he tells them what kind of books they have to read, and he tells them how to pick locks, yeah, how to break into houses and so, because he thinks that's important for a filmmaker or whatever. So this you pay 1,500. Okay, but it's and then the last thing I mention here is The Voice, and of course The Voice is also an expression of the body, and it's very typical for his documentary films that you hear he comments his own films. Yeah, he doesn't have professional speakers, but it's always him. And this is since in the earliest documentaries that he did in the early 1970s, he still had other people doing that job. It was in 1974 for this film I've told you about, it about the ski jumper, and this film was for a television series, and the television series for the series, it was necessary that the filmmaker would appear in person and act as a kind of reporter also. And so he had to appear in this film, and he had to comment on this ski jumper and so on camera, because that was just the format of this television series. And so this was the first time that he did it, and obviously he then thought, oh, this is maybe a great idea, and he, from that moment on, he always did it until today. All these documentaries, it's always him. And he, like in Grizzly Man, there's also one sequence where you see him on camera, but if you don't see him, you always hear his voice. And I mean, for example, this Brett Prager, I've quoted him already a few times from his American perspective. He says, anyone will likely find themselves hypnotized by the sound of his voice. To some it seems sage, to others paternalistic, and to some it is just quintessentially German. So this is the American perspective in German. I mean, he has a particular way of speaking in German. He has this southern accent, and also he has quite a soft but a very serious way of speaking, and it's a little bit monotonous, and there are many people in Germany who absolutely dislike his way of speaking and his voice. In America, they somehow love it. I think this, because it's not normal nowadays for documentary filmmakers that they comment all their films themselves. And in his case, it seems that it also adds a bit to the authenticity of the whole project, and it brings his own body somehow into the game. So this is the authenticity of the body and the authenticity of the content, so giving the impression of being true or false. Truth would be the second definition of authenticity as I've given it. And truth is a very important word for Herzog. I will talk about it also in the second lecture when I talk about the cinema vérité, which is the cinema truth. And ecstatic truth is something that he is constantly referring to when talking about the aim of his films, of his filmmakings. And ecstasy, normally, this comes, of course, from the spiritual or religious sphere, and it means something like the mind, as I've said when I talked about traveling on foot, the mind leaves the body, it goes somewhere beyond the body, and the ecstatic truth, and it goes beyond, or it leaves the body in order to have then new sensations, so new other sensations than the normal sensations inside your body, maybe, but it's all about sensation. And in the case of ecstatic truth, then one could say that one has to go beyond the truth to achieve truth. So one has to leave the truth first to go to the truth in the end. And this is exactly his policy of truth in the films. And another important keyword that he is always using is stylization. Yeah, the stylization of truth. And I will give you an example. So the first aspect of ecstatic truth then that I'm giving is stylization of the world. And I give you an example from from a film that he made in Siberia, Bells of the Deep. By the way, yesterday I was looking for a word. It was a superstition. So there is faith and there is superstition. Faith is like the official Catholic or faith or a Buddhistic faith and so on, and superstition is something more pagan, yeah, more not official kind of faith. And this film is about superstition in Siberia. And one has to know that Herzog was married in the 70s, and he has, for example, a son with that woman Marti Grohmann in the 70s. And by the way, his woman of that time, his wife of that time, Marti Grohmann, she helped Lotte Eisner also to write her memoirs and so on. But now, since in his American part of his life, now he has he's married again to a much younger woman who is from Siberia, a photographer from Siberia. So he's interested in Siberia, and he went there to film superstition. And for example, there is some guy who says that he is Jesus Christ, and he really looks like Jesus Christ and so on. And there are many characters like that, obviously, in Siberia. And and then there is a famous sequence in which it says pilgrims on thin ice seeking a vision of the city of Kizesh or whatever. It's the legend, I think, of a sunken city in a lake, and the lake is frozen, and he says that sometimes pilgrims go there and look for the city and hear the bells of the church that is under the ice and something like that. And I show you a portion of that. I don't think that we have to see all of that. This woman is going to tell the story, but you will see there are more of them in the background.
Suddenly the pig turned on me. I held this around the lake. But I was afraid of the dark, and I didn't want to crawl around it anymore. Then suddenly I heard singing.
And the whole story about this, he says in that film, he claims that these are pilgrims, yeah, who are looking for this sunken city. In reality, those two guys were really, really drunk. He just went to a pub and he paid them to come with him. And one of them, fell to sleep, and they had almost to cut him from the eyes in the end, I think. And so, this is the truth behind it. And so this is the Herzogian ecstatic truth. Yeah, you have to go beyond the truth to go to the real truth. That means that he makes a film about superstition in Russia, and this superstition exists. But now he has to find good images, you know, to because this film has, I don't know, 80 minutes. He only has 80 minutes and a certain amount of time and space to tell his audience about the superstition in Russia. So he needs very good images, you know, that the people immediately understand what it's all about. And he says, okay, it's important to have images that have an inner truth, but it's not important that these images are factual. This is absolutely not important. So I'm a filmmaker. I have to invent things that in the end are more true than the factual truth. This is his ecstatic truth. And I mean, this is, I think what is very important is that he's not trying to lie to you or to fake, because he is always talking overtly about these things. Yeah, it's not that, you know, he puts those guys there, and of course, in the film itself, then he claims that these guys are pilgrims. But when he talks about the film, he immediately says, "No, of course they were drunk. I have paid them," and so on. So he doesn't make a secret out of it. He doesn't want to lie to anybody. He just says, "No, no, it's important that I do it, because it wouldn't be as clear and impressive as it is now if I would have done it otherwise, and if I would have sticked to the to only the facts that I have seen there." So so one could call that the stylization of the world. And then another aspect would be the world stylizes itself. Of course, this is something that Herzog has never done, telling about different aspects of the aesthetic truth. I just try to make a distinction between several aspects now to make it a bit clearer of what we are talking. And the world stylizes itself. I mean by that that there are many sequences in his films where he films especially landscapes, and I think he delivers a kind of interpretation with the image by putting music onto it. He works a lot with music. That's why I said that I find in this Invincible film the music is quite disappointing, because I find it very kitschy. But normally he works with other types of music, and he says about himself, for example, that very few filmmakers in the whole history of cinema had such a sense for music like himself. So he thinks that he is very good in choosing the right music for the images. And I think with this approach, he of course tries to stylize the images of the landscapes and of the world that he gives, because, you know, with a sound can change a lot when you look at an image. Of course, it's very important. And I give you one example, which is one of the most famous landscape shots of his cinema. It's the first shot or the first sequence of the film Aguirre, with which shot in Peru, with which he gained international reputation for the first time. And the music, and it's also, you can, I mean, he works, of course, with some classical music, old music, and so on. But he also has particular composers with whom he works for many, many, many films. That means for his first 20 years or so, he worked always with a guy called Florian Fricke that had a band named Popol Vuh. I think this is the name of a holy book from the Mayas or so. And the music, for example, in this film is by Popol Vuh, and the music in all of his fiction films from the 70s, all from this band. And now, since many years, he works with a Dutch guy named Eric Reisiger or so. And so he sticks very much to the same collaborators.
See the jungle. In the morning I read mass, and then we descended through the clouds.
So, of course, as you can see, it's a film about the conquerors, adventurers, and discoverers, the Spanish in the 16th century in South America. And there are two things about this shot. I mean, he tells that they went there, and the whole day it was so foggy they couldn't see their hands. And then when eventually they really had to shoot, because it was the last moment that they could, because of the light and the time and so on, then like magic, you know, the fog went away, and he could do this. It's really a nice shot, I think, with half of the image in fog and the other half, exactly the half where the people come, is without fog. Yeah? And that was only that moment for days. And I mean, this is, if you have seen this film, My Best Fiend, about his relationship with Kinski. I mean, it's famous. Kinski was famous for struggling about everything during the shooting. And here, for example, Kinski said, come on, I am the protagonist of this movie, so you have to start here with a close shot of myself. I'm walking here in the mountains. So, and Herzog said, no, this is not what I want. I want to have this long shot, you know. It's much more beautiful than your face. And so, and so the word stylizes itself. And then another point would be revealing other people's inner truth. And I've already told you yesterday about this film with Reinhold Messner, where he wakes him up and says, okay, how was it when your brother died and you had to tell it your mother and so on, and was it your fault or not? And this is exactly, I think, one example for that. I can give you a quote Herzog says in this interview book. I think that put under extreme pressure, people give you many more insights into their innermost being and tell us about who we really are. And this is something that he has repeatedly said. Yeah, the camera is merciless. Yeah, and as I've told you, he said this. Reinhold Messner is such a media person, and he said, I have to break his media rap. Yeah, I have to go inside him. And I think maybe one other thing you could say about revealing other people's inner truth is this technique. I've already mentioned it, that he applied, for example, to Dieter Dengler, also to Juliane Köpke, to this woman who survived the plane crash. But by the way, also to himself in this film, My Best Fiend, is to take victims to the place of their ordeal so that they can relive these moments of their life and remember it. And because he takes, in My Best Fiend, he takes himself back to the places where he shot his movies with Klaus Kinski in order to remember all the struggles. And this is also, and I've told you that this is something which was kind of invented by Claude Lanzmann for his film Shoah about the Holocaust. With, I think, one very important difference between those two, that is that in Herzog's case, most of these things are scripted. That means that, for example, this Dieter Dengler in Little Dieter Needs to Fly, who was that pilot and shot down and prisoner of war and escaped in the jungle, he is, when you look at this documentary with him, you can see that he talks very fast, and he seems to be a very good narrator. It's really great how he tells the stories. But the reality is that Herzog had, when they started shooting, that Herzog had to stop him because he felt that Dieter was explaining and narrating many details that were absolutely unnecessary and not interesting at all, and so on. So he first of all listened to the stories of Dieter Dengler, and then one is he told him what to say, how to say it, when to say it, and he also invented other details that seemed for him more true and interesting and made Dieter tell those details as if they were really part of his story. Yeah, so this is maybe a big difference to what Claude Lanzmann did about the Shoah, because I don't think that he invented a lot there. So this is about revealing. Of course, this has to do with stylization again. Yeah, this is always this mechanism that he says, okay, I am the filmmaker and my job is to understand the point and then to tell how to make the image or how to tell the story. To make it clear to my audience. Yeah, and as a contrast to revealing other people's inner truth, there is, of course, something like revealing one's own inner truth, for example, by traveling on foot and going to one's limits and thereby entering a state of hallucination of dreams and visions. And I want to come now to another point, which we could call ecstatic motifs or ecstatic topics. And these are recurring motifs in his films that are, of course, directly linked to what I've told you about authenticity and ecstatic truth. And the first point would be the characters in Herzog's film. So one could say that he is interested in ecstatic characters. The film scholar Thomas Elsesser has once, about 20 years ago, written about Herzog's cinema that the characters in Herzog's films, fiction films mostly, were overreachers or underdogs. And I mean, with overreachers, for example, he of course means people like the strong man, or like the people Klaus Kinski incorporates. And with underdogs, he means of course the handicapped and all the outcasts, all the people who have problems with communication, that you can Kaspar Hauser and so on, that you find in his films. And I mean, why are those characters ecstatic characters? Because, for example, his overreachers, when he depicts a strong man, it's not like Arnold Schwarzenegger or Bruce Willis or so, it's not, or Sylvester Stallone, it's not a strong man that is so strong that he will win in the end. No, never. But the point with Herzog is, it's a very strong man, but eventually he will fail. That's the important thing, and that's why it's an ecstatic character. It's if Herzog's strongman is as strong as Sisyphus, one could say. He's very strong, you know. He can roll the rock up the mountain endlessly, but he will never succeed. Yeah. So this is the ecstatic point of the character. And on the other hand, the underdogs are underdogs. They are outcasts. They are somehow not part of the society. But by their defect, one could say, they always prove that they are much more human, much more normal than the so-called normal civilization. That's the point about them. So this is their ecstasy, one could say, if you want to. Yeah? So this ecstatic characters. then, of course, I mean, pilgrimage, yeah. I have talked a lot now about walking on foot and traveling on foot, and how that adds to ecstasy and authenticity. And, of course, for Herzog, pilgrimage is maybe the highest ranked discipline of traveling on foot. And it is interesting, first of all, to note that although he talks so much about his own travels on foot, there is no, he has never done a film about him traveling on foot. I mean, okay, in this portrait we can see him walking around a little, but it's not really a film about traveling on foot. He has never traveled for 1,000 kilometers on foot and took and taking a camera with him and filming it. Never. I think this is interesting because I could imagine that it could be an exciting film, but he has never thought about it. There is, from the 1970s, one film made by a student of the Munich Film Academy, and it has a title Herzog's Travels on Foot or something like that. So maybe this film is a little bit about it, only that the film is not extant. You can't find it. I've asked at this archive of the student film academy, and they don't have the film anymore. So you will never know if this film was about it or not. I want to show you a few examples of how pilgrimages, or how travels on foot appear in many of his films. And the first thing that I want to show you is not exactly a travel on a traveling on foot, but it's from the beginning of the film Kaspar Hauser, and the point here is that Kaspar, so this guy who was who spent his first the first years of his life in a cave somehow, and mostly bound with a rope or something. He had to learn everything from scrap, and in this film about Kaspar Hauser, the first thing, of course, that Kaspar has to learn is to walk. And somehow it seems that, I mean, you will see it how this is staged in the film. It seems that when he learns to walk, that this means life for him. Later then, he learns other things like writing and speaking, and so this enables him to be kind of part of the society, but this will not make him happy. It's more important that he learns how to walk. This is the beginning of his life, and I will show that to you. So this is a guy you will never know who exactly he is. So he's supposed to be one of the bad guys who had hold Kaspar prisoner, and he brings him out of the cave and teaches him then how to walk, and gives him a note with some words on it, and then he goes away. So that just for an impression, I show you sequence of Nosferatu. This is where, I mean, Nosferatu is just a Dracula story. It's only for copyright reasons that they had to call it Nosferatu and couldn't call it Dracula. And this is when this guy it's the story, yeah, that this guy is sent by his boss to Romania or Transylvania or to the Count Dracula to make a contract. And in Herzog's film, this is mostly a travel on foot, and of course it's travel through a landscape that is somehow an inner landscape. He's traveling in the image, in the depiction, he's traveling through a country or to another country, but the symbolical value is that he is traveling, I think, inside himself. But I will talk a bit more about it later. I'll just show you the sequence.
Thank you.
I've shown you the whole sequence because I will talk about this later when it comes to romanticism, which is also an important concept. But I just want to show you a short one from Invincible because this, as you can see here, this...
But don't ever forget who you are.
Also this Polish-Jewish blacksmith, when he goes from his little village in somewhere in Poland to Berlin, he goes obviously on foot. And what is kind of interesting is that in Nosferatu, there is someone going from a city in Western Europe to the countryside in Eastern Europe, and in this film there's someone going from the Eastern country, the countryside in Eastern Europe to a city in Western Europe. But in both films, at the end of the travel, they will meet somebody in a black cape, which in one case is Dracula, and in this case is the boss of the cabaret, the Magic Henderson, who wears just the same black cape as Dracula. And funny for me is that I've only realized that now that in the Kaspar Hauser film, the guy who teaches him walking, he also has this kind of black cape like Dracula. So this is also a kind of recurring motif. And but I have, of course, I mean, you have noted when I've shown you all the film titles yesterday of the films that Herzog made, there is, for example, one film that is called Pilgrimage. So he has made some kind of documentaries about pilgrims, and he has also made a film about Buddhism. And in this film, he concentrates on some pilgrims who came because there is this reunion when pilgrims from everywhere, they come to a place where the Dalai Lama also comes, and they make their Kala Chakra, or what it is called, this kind of mosaic landscape, and that depicts the soul or so, and then in the end when it's ready it will be destroyed again and so on. There's this Buddhism stuff, and in this film he shows some of this pilgrims, how in what way they went to this festivity, and then he interviews one of them, and I think this interview says a lot about his fascinations for pilgrims. I only have to find the clip, just a second. I don't have to find it here because it's the DVD.
Sie sind tausende von Kilometern mit Lastwagen unterwegs gewesen. Jedoch viele der Pilger aus dem inneren Tibets kamen zu Fuß. Zurückgelegt. zweiten Tag der Festlichkeiten trafen wir diesen Mönch. Er hatte in Niederwerfung in mehr als 4000 Kilometer zurückgelegt, die gesamte Strecke von der Provinz Amdo weit jenseits der autonomen Republik Tibet. Er erzählt, dass seine Reise mehr als 3,5 Jahre gedauert hat. Er stammt aus einer so entlegenen Provinz, dass sein Dialekt über 2 Dolmetscher erst ins Hochtibetische und von dort für uns übersetzt werden musste. Unterwegs gab es Hunger und Durst, Hitze und Kälte. Die Nachricht seines Kommens eilte ihm voraus und manchmal kamen ihm Nomaden entgegen und gaben ihm Wasser und etwas zum Essen. Von seiner Reise möchte er kein Aufhebens machen. Ja, an Knochen seiner Hand bildeten sich Überbeine, obwohl er sie mit hölzernen Schuhen schützte. Und vom Berühren des Bodens einige Millionen Mal ist eine Wunde auf seiner Stirn noch immer nicht ganz verheilt. Kann er etwas über das Ausmaß der Strecke sagen? Ja, er weiß, wie groß die Erde ist. Wie groß. Er hat sie mit seinem Körper ausgemessen, von Kopf bis Fuß. Er weiß Bescheid. Er hat sich unaufhaltsam fortbewegt und eine tiefe Gelassenheit ist jetzt über ihn gekommen, seitdem er beim Baum der Erleuchtung angelangt ist.